be the final call, because within his pages there is something for us all. And I am not professional, but I love basketball. The speaking of a stick us the echo in the hall. But if I don't have enemies, I'm not doing my job. I might throw out a curveball, but I never throw a lob. And people criticize me, but I know it's not the end. I try to kick the truth, not just to make friends. But hey, diddle, 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 diddle to the people in the middle. We got hot wax and it's cooking on the griddle. Got the guitars to rumming, the drummer, the drumming. The people all humming and the vibe was loving.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That was People in the Middle by the great Michael Fronte, born on this day in 1966. In 2009, I talked with author and producer Felicia Pride when she was then the Roots' first book columnist. She's now the head of a new media company called Pride Collaborative, the director of Storytelling Institute's Stories Lead, and the co-organizer of StoryCode DC, as well as founder of the Create Daily. In this encore presentation of The Steiner Show, we ask the question, what if African Americans were in charge of the literary world? So tell me how that came about.
I was just sort of thinking about all the changes within book publishing lately because of the recession and the advances in technology, and wondering, as an author myself, if I were more in control of things, what would I want to change? And so I thought about reaching out to fellow authors to see what their opinions were on the same question. What would they change?
Some of the people, there were some really interesting responses. You had an response from a man who's been a guest on the show several times, William Jelani Cobb.
Yes.
Who teaches at
Spelman.
Spelman College mm-hmm. in Atlanta. And a really interesting thinker, very kind of new and original thinker. And he talks about how he would make books matter again, that he wants books to be part of the culture in a way they aren't anymore. About how 30 years ago, turning TV on, you'd see the great authors like Norman Mailer and James Baldwin on talk shows taking on the world, and it was a noble profession, and it's lost, he feels.
I would agree with that, too, in terms of the sort of prominence of authors in our country, in our nation, and then the prominence of books and sort of the respect of books. I think there was a sort of wow when you said that you were an author or you're a writer or you're a novelist. And now it may be also because so many more people now are authors and writers that there mm-hmm. may not be that same sort of wow factor. But I do agree with him on wanting to raise the profile of writers and authors.
Some of the other folks who answered this question talked about the fact that so many books being, if the sense was, there's so many books coming out now, there's so many people writing books, that they've been devalued, that even the notion of what it takes to become a writer has been lost.
I definitely agree with that. I think part of that has to do with advances in technology, because now anyone can publish a book, right? You can go to Amazon or they're publishing Book Surge or something like that and upload a manuscript and they send you books. So I do think that there's a lot lost in the process of sometimes, I can't say that all the authors are not necessarily working on craft and, you know, laboring over their manuscript, but there is something lost in the process sometimes when because of the advances in technology.
So, but you, as a young woman who's a writer and involved in the internet with Blacklist and with The Root and all the other things you're writing, mm-hmm. some people look at the internet as a place that has been kind of the root of the problem, no pun intended. That
possibly. I mean, I think you can look at it twofold. You can look at it as a place where anyone can have a voice, anyone can say anything, which could be a good thing because it increases access. But then you have the other point of view where, you know, when you think about the people are talking about the future of journalism, where now bloggers are sort of taking over, you don't necessarily have those journalists who, you know, studied and went to school or did what they had to do to learn the craft of journalism, maybe you don't have those certain bloggers doing that same process. And that's the same thing with becoming an author. Are we working on our manuscripts? Are we going through the editing process? Are we doing all the things that happens within traditional publishing, even with this new technology that we have?
If you looked at the advice that the authors who came to you in this, and I what would you walk away with? I mean, I think that there's some really interesting things. I think Martha Southgate, whose works I have not read really. I've heard the name, but I've never read mm-hmm. her works. She had a really interesting idea. She said she would end MFA programs in writing and focus on literature and reading.
Yes. I don't know about how if I would end MFA programs in writing, but I do agree with her opinion on reading and becoming more critical readers and how becoming more critical readers adds to your ability to write well. I definitely agree with that. I think that maybe what she could be possibly also saying is that some of these writing programs, there's so much concentration on the craft of it that we forget about the sort of partner of writing, which is reading.
Talk about, I mean, your focus for your own life on writing.
Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily think I was going to become a writer. I can say that. I went to Towson and went for a marketing degree. I thought I was going to be in business, was bored.
What happened?
Bored.
Bored, capital B.
Bored, so bored that I started writing. I started writing these sort of rhythmic things, which I wouldn't call poetry, but these rhythmic things. And then I started interning for a newspaper in New York. That's where I was living at the time. And when I saw my byline for the first time, that's what got me.
And what was your first byline?
It was a review of a Mary J. Blige album. So I started writing about music. But then when I decided, oh, wow, maybe I should really pursue this seriously, that's when I went back to school, went to Emerson, and was actually in the writing program, the writing literature and publishing program. But my concentration was book publishing because I actually wanted to work in the industry. And that's what I did when I graduated. I worked in book publishing and still was not one who said I was a writer. I wrote, but I never said I'm a writer. But then slowly, surely made the transition into writer and still do other things, but I try to say that when people ask me what I do say writer first, finally.
On your title is writer. Yes. Writer comes first.
Yes.
So talk a bit about, before we come back to your list, because I really am enthralled by some of these people, how they responded to your questions. Abiola Abrams and some others said some interesting things to you I want to reflect on. But 100 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs.
Yes.
It's for a lot of older people and the media, it remains a vilified genre.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a war within hip hop itself over who.
Yes,
we are.
Definitely. And I get that a lot when people see the book. If they pick it up originally, they may put it back down because just the word hip hop turns them off. But that was sort of one of my goals in writing the book, was to show that there is power in the music. There is power in the words of many of these young people. But I make it a point to say that, you know, not all of it I found meaning in it. Not all of it has a lot of substance. Not all of it is healthy. And I think that there is a large part of the hip hop generation or those who identify with hip hop who say that. I think that we sort of overshadow media overshadows our voices in that and our criticisms, that we do have criticism of hip hop, but we also do feel like there's power in it. And so that was what I wanted to show, was the sort of life lessons and wisdoms that I was able to get from specific hip hop songs.
So when Christopher Chambers writes in response to your...
Yeah, I know how Christian, he's yes.
Let me read what he said, we can talk about it. He writes, all book publishing houses shall immediately be divested from conglomerate parent corporations, interesting, which when you get down to it is the real problem. Then all book deals with ex-porn stars, rappers, felons, video rump shakers, mega preachers, unless the book is theology rather than love and money, be canceled and advances forfeited. That they start with that.
Yes.
I like that.
Chris has always been very very outspoken in his opinions about the publishing industry, and that's why I wanted him as one of the voices in here, because I wanted his perspective in there. I don't always agree with what he has to say, but he always has a strong perspective. And he also is sort of one of those who is trying to highlight works by black authors that he feels should get more attention. And so I respect that. Do I think that all rappers shouldn't write books? No. Do I think, you know, do I agree with his list? Not necessarily, but I think he has a strong perspective, and that's why I wanted to include him.
Well, talk to me about what Christopher Chambers wrote, that I kind of really kind of found interesting, was that what he's saying to me here is that when you have all these books coming out, almost ad nauseum, ex-porn stars, rappers, felons, video rump shakers, mega preachers who preach about love and money as opposed to theology and religion. What he's saying to us is that we're being flooded with crap in our bookstores and everywhere we see, and the kind of real substance, as William Jelani Cobb was saying to you, was that we We've lost the substance of what it means to be a great writer and encouraging people to read the great stuff and having just kind of that stuff come through instead of all waiting through all the pile of stuff we can't mention on the air.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that part of that has to do with the publishing industry having this still stuck on that blockbuster and the celebrity big book. They have this, you know, they put so much time, energy, and money into these big celebrity books that a lot of the books that are of substance, like you said, that Dr. Cobb is talking about, they get lost in the shuffle. And so that's why we need more outlets to talk about those books that are getting lost in the shuffle, because a lot of the media attention goes to the celebrities and the reality stars. And that shows that's part of our American culture, is that we have this sort of fascination with these types of characters. And so when you have these quieter books, or you have these books that, you know, are by that MFA student who labored on it, that's not necessarily what's sexy. And I think that's a problem within the publishing industry, but it's a problem within the publishing industry that's very much reflected by American culture.
Felicia Pride is joining us here. She is author of the message 100 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs. We're talking about her question to a number of great African-American writers. Supposing you ran the literary world, what would you do? And what would you do? And what are you reading now? Let me read this one. I'll say the name after I read it, so you won't know who's coming, but you'll know as soon as I say it. Writers such as Paul Beattie, Touré, and Junot Diaz would be pushed in high school classrooms like crack is on the block. It's high time we stop forcing dead white guys on kids who can't identify with them and introduce teens to great stories they can get into. Also, this is the part I like. Also, I'd bubble wrap every last one of the hyper-sexualized urban fiction covers in my local bookstore so moms like me wouldn't be so damn embarrassed to take our kids to the African-American quote-unquote literature section. Oh, and 14-year-olds wouldn't read Zane like ever. So, and that was Deneen Milner.
Yes.
So let's take it backwards. I mean, the whole world of new urban fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's taken that on front on, and that's a dangerous thing to take on because it's become such a popular medium.
Right. And what's interesting is that her husband, Nick Childs, took it on in the New York Times with a piece a few years back called Their Eyes Were Reading Smut.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So they definitely have shared views somewhat on that topic. I think...
What do you think?
With urban fiction, I go back and forth. Part of me... I think one of the big problems with it is that a lot of young people are reading it. And it's not written for young people. It's not traditional YA. So what we have is our young people who want to read up, but in their minds, what they're doing is reading what books they can quote unquote relate to, which tells me that they're feeling like there's a void out there in the marketplace, that they feel like they're not being addressed. So that's a whole community that needs to be addressed, but in a way that is on their level and appropriate for them. Urban fiction kind of moved in and said, hey, you know, you can recognize certain characters from your neighborhood possibly, but it's not written for young adults. So I definitely see Deneen's problem with that. I'm not one of those who say, you know, no urban fiction in the bookstores. I don't necessarily feel that way. I like a good story. But some of the urban fiction that I've read, it's not at that level. What I would love to see is some smart, quote unquote, urban fiction, which again, I don't even know how I feel about that title, urban fiction. But I would love to see some smart street fiction that's written well. That's my thing. If you have a story to tell, write it well. I think one of the problems is a lot of publishers started throwing a lot of money at people who quote unquote claim they were street lit authors.
Right.
Instead of really thinking about this could be a genre that could really, really attract a certain demographic. And why don't we try to do the same thing that we do with other books and ensure that it's written well and ensure that there's some substance behind it. You can talk about what's going on in the block and the neighborhood, but still try to put some substance behind it. But again, I'm not one of those who wants to lump it all together saying it's all bad, it's all this. But I personally, as an author, don't want literature to become, or books to become, a cash cow to people. You know, they see dollar signs and like, oh, I can get a book deal. I'll just write a story about, you know, coming out of jail. Well, no, people spend a lot of time to sort of become good writers. That's not, that I don't like.
I mean, because is there a contradiction maybe what you're saying when we talk about, now I love Junot Diaz, I think, incredible mm-hmm. writer.
He'll be at City Lit this weekend.
I think he's an amazing writer.
Mm-hmm.
So is Paul Beattie. Touré, I have not read, so I can't.
I really like Touré's books. Very, very imaginative, very different, but they're very good.
So if you take what Janine says, let's take how we learn how to read, how to write by what we read,
mm-hmm.
and we only give our children in schools books that relate to who they are, as opposed to quote-unquote dead white guys, or dead anybody, just guys mm-hmm. or women, are we doing our kids a disservice? Because let's say we have a white suburban kid in any place, or a white urban kid in any place. Well, does that mean they shouldn't read Juno Diaz? They shouldn't read James Baldwin from the past? Does that mean that black kids should not read William Shakespeare or Norman Mailer? I mean,
I don't think that's necessarily what she's saying, that we should just push these writers. What she's saying, I don't want to speak for her, but what my opinion is on it.
I wouldn't expect you to. But
and especially because I do work with young people in the libraries here in mm-hmm. Baltimore City, trying to get them to read, and it can be a struggle, is that some of our young people we need to meet them where they are at times so that we can take them someplace else. So maybe we do bring them a book that they can see themselves in so that we sort of whet their appetite for reading. And then we take them into the direction of a James Baldwin or whoever it may be. We open it, we expand their horizons. But for many young people who are in schools and are turned off by reading because they don't see themselves in it, we want to be able to get them back into it, say, hey, here's a book that you might enjoy. And once they start to get engaged in the reading process because they have something that actually engages them, then we start to expand their horizons and expose them to different type of literature. I think with some of our young people, we definitely need to meet them where they are.
As we go into the first callers coming in, tell me what you're reading now. What has you at the moment?
Oh, I'm reading The Other Side of Paradise by Stacey Ann Chin,
uh-huh.
who's a poet. And it is great. Like, it's one of those books and where, you know, you're it's so good that you can't wait to start reading it again. So that's how I feel about the book so far. It's really good. It's her memoir and actually came out today. Oh, yesterday, a Tuesday, April 14th.
And what did you read just before that?
Just before that, I read Ho Love Strong by Matthew Goodman, which also came out yesterday. And I think he is a BNN Discover new writer, so he's a new writer on the scene.
I've not read him either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you turn me on to two new people here. Felicia Pride's in the studio, and Sarah in Hartford County, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just perchance happens to be listening and tuned into the show. And I think that the thing that she was bringing about urban literature,
mm-hmm.
Now I am a white woman, I'm 29 years old, but I have read some of the Triple Crown books. I can't remember her name. You know what I'm talking about?
Vicki Stringer?
Wahida Clark.
Wahida Clark, okay.
Yes, I read the book Payback is a Mother. But then I also read, and that book is very, very graphic. Children should not read it. I wouldn't let my child read it. But I also read a book, a wonderful book, by, I believe the author's name is Omar Tyree,
mm-hmm.
and it was called Sweet St. Louis, and I love that book. I absolutely love that book.
You know
yes, and Omar Tyree, he sort of credits himself with being like the father of urban fiction because he was out in the early 90s writing
right.
for a different demographic. He's not like hardcore urban fiction like
right.
your like Wahida Clark or Vicki Stringer or Shannon Holmes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was actually my point. I read the Wahida Clark book. It was interesting. It was entertaining. But the Sweet St. Louis made me think a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I really very much enjoyed that book. The last book I read was actually Stephen Colbert's, since you guys asked. Stephen Colbert's I'm American, So Can You.
That's a funny book.
Yes, that is a great book.
That's a very funny book.
And the book I'm reading right now is about Lizzie Borden. I don't have the book in front of me, so I don't know who it's written by. And I'm also going to start reading books about menopause. One's called The Pause, and the other one is called 101 Things You Wanted to Know About Menopause.
All right. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I just finished reading William Julius Wilson's book for the show we just did with him.
Oh, yes.
It was a brilliant book. And reading Laura Lippman's new book at the moment.
Oh.
That's a woman who's gone from... She's become, I think, one of America's greatest mystery writers.
And I'm just amazed at just how prolific she is.
She's amazing. Amazing writer. Can't wait to have her on talk about this particular book, because this book crosses all these racial lines and talks about Baltimore in some really interesting ways. I'm just loving this book. It's also a good mystery.
I'll have to add it to my list.
Oh, absolutely. Ray in Columbia, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to thank Ms. Pride for, you know, her comment about, you know, using our, you know, books that our kids can relate to as a hook to really introduce them to other books that really broaden their horizons.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to thank Ms. Pride for the book she's written. I did just start it, and also want to thank her for the wonderful work she's done with the Saturday Academy kids of 100 Black Men of Maryland that she's had a couple of sessions with, and really her style and her approach really gets kids interested where they do broaden their horizons, which is true to her comment.
Thank you.
And I'm the president of 100 Black Men, so I want to thank you for all you've done.
Thank you so much.
Ray, thank you for calling in. We all need fan clubs. That's good. Nancy, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
This is such an interesting conversation today. I'm in a book club, and it's a bunch of women. We're all in our late 30s, early 40s, and the books that we have chosen to read, there was a lot of back and forth on email, several email arguments, because several of the women in our club thought that the books that we were choosing were too highbrow, and they wanted us to kind of dummy down the selection. We had books like Go Tell It on a Mountain, and we had Emperor of Ocean Park, and, you know, just books that were not the usual Cat in the Hat kinds of books. That's what we kind of started calling some of the urban fiction. Can we get a word that's more than, you know, three letters, or can we get a three-syllable word in the whole book? So, you know, it's interesting, you know, just some of the things that's coming out that, you know, we often have to go back in time and read some of the good old classics in order to get, you know, in order to be challenged literally.
I think that that's really a very strong point.
I would definitely agree.
I mean, Go Tell the Mountain and Baldwin's work, especially that, the early Baldwin, the first half of his writing, was some of the most powerful writing ever in American literature.
Definitely. I think that, and that goes back to my point of, and also Martha Southgate's point about being critical readers. And sometimes when we read things in different places in our lives, we don't see it all. And then when you read as a reader versus read as a writer, you don't see it all as well. So I definitely agree with her comment about going back to,
because
a lot
sometimes
of
I think what Nancy's talking about is people read to be titillated as opposed to chewing on the words.
That's very true.
Chewing on the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, maybe I'm just old fashioned. I like books that I can chew on, that kind of do something to me as I'm going through them, that make me think as I'm going through it.
Right. But I think also that we shouldn't dismiss the idea of reading as an escapism or as entertainment for some people. Yeah, definitely. Or the different types of escapism that we can have. Some people fall in love with romance novels because that, you know, it takes them to another place.
Do you have a favorite romance novel?
I don't read a lot of romance.
I don't either. I was just curious. I thought maybe you did. Just checking. So, and your list of authors, Aviola Abrams said that she's thinking in her world, literary world, parents would quote Baldwin, Hansberry, Angelou, Morrison on a daily basis to their children. Artists would be supported emotionally by their communities and regarded as valuable as lawyers and bankers. Amen to that. Hip hop would be a non-commodified art that would have an even stronger literary presence. So what would we do tomorrow? Same thing we should try every day, try to take over the world.
Yes, I think I think her point was the fact that, and that's one of the issues with some of our young people not reading. You know, we'll have adults always saying, you know, young people aren't reading, but how many of our adults are reading? And how many our young people are seeing the adults reading? So I think that kind of speaks to Aviola's point about being able to quote literature and be familiar with literature.
That was an encore presentation of my 2009 interview with Baltimore author and media producer Felicia Pride. If you have thoughts about what you just heard, please tweet me at Mark Steiner or write me at steinershow@gmail.com. And what you're hearing now is Mississippi Goddamn, one of the most famous songs done by Nina Simone, who just could not stand what was happening in the segregationist South after the murders of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, wrote that song One of the powerful songs of the movement, that she didn't mean to do that, but it ended up as that. When we come back from this break, we're going to celebrate Nina Simone's life on the day she passed away in 2003.
Gone home now. Gone home now. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. Alabama's got me so upset. California's made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand this pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Tennessee's made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you, me and my people just about do. I've been there, so I know, they keep on saying go slow. That's what they say, go slow, that's what they say, go slow. That's what's the trouble.